The violin, it's always been the center of my life since 10 years old. I saw Itzhak Perlman play with the St. Louis Symphony, and I told my mom, like, I think I can do that. And so my parents, they were kind of putting it off, I could see, both being doctors. My dad's a pathologist. My mom's actually a doctor of music education. And so they knew the field. They know what it takes to really make it. If you're going to make it as a musician, you can probably do anything because of the work put in. Sometimes you have to practice 4-6 hours a day to make it. And that's as a youngster. So you really have to be top notch at your skills to make it as a musician in the musical field. So they knew what it took, and I think they sort of discouraged it, but I bought my own violin at 10, and whenever they saw the work that I was putting in on it, learning almost a piece every day or two, and just kept going with it, just loved it, then they financially supported me, and mentally, in every way, they supported me to the hilt.
They sent you to Juilliard to get you evaluated.
Yes, with Dorothy DeLay, who is Itzhak Perlman's teacher. She ran the Juilliard pre-college program, which is what they involved me with there, and also the Starling String Project in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I studied with Kurt Sosmanshaus, who's a great German professor there at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. So they'd basically send me all around the world, and they also sent me to study with Almeida and Roland Vamos, who were located in Chicago, not far from here. They just wanted me to have the best training because they knew what it took to make it in music. As I said from the start, it's not easy, and they know how to do it as far as education. You have to really go for the best to make it in today's world.
And then you went on to get your Master's of Music in South Florida.
Yes, from Lynn University Conservatory of Music, I had an opportunity to study with Elmar Oliveira. He's the only American violinist to win the Tchaikovsky competition in Russia, believe it or not. So that's a very, very difficult thing to do. And it's always been one of my kind of inspired competitions to eventually maybe one day be on the tier of those players and the top tier players like Josh Bell and people that are really on that top tier of playing.
People compare you to Joshua Bell and also Tiger Woods.
Yes. Well, that was back when Tiger Woods was winning. But yes, it's great to be compared to the greats. And, you know, I haven't made it there yet, I have to say, as far as the business. Why is Josh Bell getting paid $100,000 a concert? And I get a small percentage of that. There's something more that it takes. You have to build your name. You have to build your reputation. He did it in his own way. And I have to have my way as well. The ways that have already been taken, those avenues are full, in my opinion. So you have to be unique. You have to come up with your own way of thinking and something that people are going to want and love and have to buy.
You've sort of expanded how you're doing things, not only as a performer, but you've really gotten into education and doing things with young people.
Yes, sort of become the main part of my life to change young people's lives as well. And you have to keep doing concerts, you have to play to stay relevant as a performer. So I still try to play 5-6 big concerts like with this Dubuque Symphony every year. As far as my classical career, I'm also slightly crossing over into more pop music as well, because with youngsters, they don't want to hear Shostakovich. They don't want to hear Bartok concerto for violin whenever I'm sitting playing for some third graders. They might want to hear the new Justin Timberlake song off of the movie Trolls, or the theme from Moana, from the Disney movie Moana. And that's what bridges the gap of unfamiliarity for the kids to get to classical music concerts and want to one day go listen to the Vivaldi Four Seasons, which in my mind, I see just as many pictures and colors in the phrases of music that they see in the Moana and in the Shrek and all the fun movies, because that's what music trains the mind to do, to create pictures, to make you travel and go places and really just open up the mind.
So you have your wonderful acoustic violin, but you also have an electric violin, which you just hinted at.
Yes, I just got it about 3 years ago, and most of my income is from the electric violin now, especially living down in South Florida. It's a little different in South Florida because people are there for fun. People are there for entertainment. And yes, the classical halls do fill up. They sell out. But that's with Itzhak Perlman. That's with Joshua Bell. They bring in the big household names because they sell the concerts out. That's what they have to do. And I have to continue to build my reputation as a soloist, as an artist, as a person of the world. And that's why I have this electric violin now for me. It's kind of a way for me to cross over and bridge that gap of unfamiliarity to more of what my dad always called the laity. Those are the people that don't know everything that's going on in classical music, which is 99% of people. So if I can grab some of them, then I'll have my following as well. But that has to do with popular music and things that are popular to everyone.
You've played with a whole bunch of different orchestras. Tell us about some of the orchestras you've appeared with.
Basically, all of the major symphony orchestras in the United States. I've traveled South Africa, the Netherlands, over in Asia. And it's been just quite an experience of a life to get to do that, I feel. I almost feel like certain people are chosen to do this in a way. And it's a blessing in every way, because you want to be a soloist as a kid. That's what you strive for, of course. And I was actually never a good orchestra player. I feel like it's the way my body's shaped, my posture. I always had to fight with that. And so the soloist was just the thing that was meant to be. It was either that or nothing at all, really, for me. I would have had to do something else. So luckily, I found my avenues in music, which is being a soloist, playing my concerts, playing gigs around my local area, also teaching. I have a private studio of almost 20 students right now. I teach in a couple of schools. I just pop into the after-school programs, try to help out kids in the inner-city programs that wouldn't possibly get any of these opportunities ever. I've found quite a few very, very talented kids in there. It's quite amazing. You change their lives and they go on to really respect you as a great teacher for the rest of their lives. It's quite an amazing feeling. And I'm just all about making the world a better place. I don't want to be in the spotlight. I'm not that guy. Like, I want to be the superstar, but I want to change the world and bring people together through music. And this is actually my fourth appearance with Dubuque Symphony. I've played Vivaldi 4 seasons. Then I played Sibelius Concerto. And the first time I was here, it was Mendelssohn Violin Concerto in E minor.
Well, tell us about the 2 Vivaldi movements that you're going to be playing with the Dubuque Symphony.
Well, 2 of the concertos. I'm going to be doing the spring and the summer concertos, which each have 3 movements in them. And they're absolutely beautiful pieces. As I said, I see as many pictures and colors going on whenever I hear this music. Whether I open my eyes or close them, I see things going on. It doesn't matter for me. As many as the kids see whenever they watch a Disney movie or a play or something fun. The music was meant to be picture music. And each different section actually follows a poem, and it goes beautifully with the music. In the spring, you can hear the birds chirping, the sun rising, all of these different aspects of the music. And in the summer, you hear the cuckoo bird, and you can feel the dreariness of the heat in the slowness that it starts out with. And just the different sections, you can really feel these seasons come to life if you have an open mind.
So how long have you been playing different concertos from the 4 seasons?
I've been playing the 4 seasons since I was around 16 years old. I started violin at 10, And Vivaldi concertos, that's how you start learning the violin in the first couple of years of training, like the A minor Vivaldi concerto and the G minor. But the Vivaldi Four Seasons are more like on the difficulty of a major concerto. And if you play all four of them together, it takes around 44, 45 minutes. So two of them will take us around 22 minutes or so. In my mind, it's the equivalent of playing like half of a major concerto. But you always have to put in the quality of work to bring these things to life, to make people feel an experience. Everyone has heard Vivaldi Four Seasons before. You've heard it in elevators. You've heard it in movies. You don't even know that you've heard it and you've heard it. So you really have to bring it to life and make people realize, why is this piece special? Why did I come to see this guy play? That's the challenge.
If you've played this so many times, then how do you keep it fresh and how do you keep it fun?
Well, as an artist, you don't want to keep on playing things the same way, in my opinion. If you keep on playing the same interpretations for years after years, you will burn out on a piece. But if you go listen to other artists from other places. Again, always keep an open mind as a musician. As soon as you start to get closed-minded, I think that that's when you start to settle in your ideas, and then you will start to burn out in your love for certain pieces. Like I hear musicians say all the time, oh, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, I've heard that a million times, I don't want to hear that. Well, listen to a different orchestra play it. Listen to it played by this conductor versus this one. And I don't think that you'll get burnt out on music if you keep that open mind about interpretations. That's how it stays exciting for me. I think it's different for everyone, of course, but that's kind of my way about going about it. And even William, the conductor, maestro, he recommended some recordings that I listened to before this performance, and it kind of sparked my whole passion for the piece again. Because I was kind of feeling like, what should I do with it this time? You know, this is the 15th time I've played it with the symphony orchestra. What should I do this time? William sent me, hey, Gareth, take a listen to this. I didn't even ask him, but he just sent it to me. And I said, wow, that's quite refreshing.
There is that big storm scene in summer. How do you feel about that?
Ooh, the storm is a lot of fun. And I like to go fast in the storm. And you can really feel it come to life. I feel like you can feel the wind, you can hear it. If you close your eyes, there's just really nothing quite like it. He really did it, in my opinion, Vivaldi. Quite a success, and I think that's the reason that people always come to hear the Four Seasons.
What are your feelings about playing with the Dubuque Symphony, about being back in Iowa and all of that?
Well, they sound more amazing than ever from last night's rehearsal, from what I heard. Very refreshing. I'm looking forward to hearing their Beethoven symphony as well. They sounded incredible. It's just always a pleasure to be here because the people here are so appreciative. As I said, in South Florida now, I do a lot of electric violin. I think if I lived in a place like this, I'd still be a purely acoustic classical violinist. Because of the care, that people really care. They support classical music. There's just more of an appreciation. There's a different look on it than where I'm from now, which is kind of a place more built on entertainment. The kids, they're all about having fun. It's warm year-round. Why would you be inside playing an instrument, right? Let's go outside. Let's play football. Let's play sports. So it's a different mentality here. And down there, it's a little different. You have to be more popular. Things are more materialistic, even, I have to say. That's why it always makes me happy to come here. This is more like my home, where I'm from, in Festus, Missouri, which is a little south of St. Louis, in the Midwest as well. I think people in the Midwest are a little different. And Vivaldi was like the pop star of his day. You know, that's really what it was. They didn't have all these synthesizers. They didn't have modern technology like what we have today. So he was really the one rocking it out back in his day. And I have to do the same in my day as well. That's why I've crossed over into some of these synths and things as well. And I almost want people to have an open mind towards what I'm doing as well, because I might introduce some of this at the concert as an encore. And I want them to see the similarities in what he did and what I have to do, just because it's a different time. And I'm also creating a CD of what I'm going to present as well. So just for future reference, so people can look out for that in the next 3 months or so. I'm not going to have my electric violin. I will do it on my Vihon violin, and I will kind of imitate what my electric violin sounds like. And it's going to be a hip-hop violin piece, which I composed. I haven't named it yet. I just wrote it 2 weeks ago. Some producers out in Los Angeles have been very, very interested in my work, and I'm actually going to go out and work with them in the next week or two. And it's a piece that I just put together over a beat that one of the producers sent me. His name's Ugly Fingers, Juan, with Sticky Fingers Productions out in Los Angeles. It's on the internet. And we'll see what we have. It's basically hip-hop violin, but I think people are going to like it.
Tell us about your violin and the one you're going to be performing here in Dubuque.
My violin is a very special violin to me. It's an 1840 French-made violin. The maker is Jean-Baptiste Vihon. And Vihon was the greatest violin maker in his day. Whenever I first got into violins, I found a Vihon at 12 years old, I believe, cost $60,000. I was like, oh man, that's so unaffordable. That's ridiculous. I played it for a couple days. The owner of the violin shop, Gene Bearden, he's passed away. He was in St. Louis. He told me you should buy that violin. And I was like, I can't afford that. My parents and I, of course. And it's interesting because, what was it, 10 years later, I bought a Vihon for over double that price. And now, 10 years later again, the price of my Vihon has doubled again. So I have over $250,000 instrument now. And I should have had two of them, because I should have bought that first one back when Gene Bearden told me to. And I'm trying to create my own music, and it's relevant to today, just as Vivaldi was to his day. And it's what's going to take me, I think, to being more of a unique and more of a needed and wanted artist, to have your own music and your own thing that you do.
So let's talk about the Vivaldi, since you're both here right now, and I don't know who picked it out.
I picked it out because it's kind of tying in with our theme of the season, which is to explore the elements in music. And the four seasons do that so brilliantly, this sort of celebration of nature, celebration of the earth, but it also has storms and bird calls and wind. And so it really actually has quite a lot of all four elements, really, earth, air, fire, and water. If you consider that the storms might have lightning, then you've got maybe a little bit of fire spark there. And we're just exploring the first two seasons here. We're focusing on spring and summer.
Have you known each other for a while, and how did you meet Gareth?
It's been about 15 years, and this is his fourth appearance with the Dubuque Symphony.
Correct.
And we've also worked together with the other orchestra I'm music director of in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And in both places, he is an audience favorite. His musicianship just lights up the stage. His energy, his personality, his sincerity, his virtuosity is incredible. So when we first found Gareth, you were so young. It was crazy, yes, man. You were early 20s, and he had fairly recently won the Sphinx competition, and that's actually how I found out about Gareth. Is some friends over there who run that competition told me about Gareth, and first I listened to him play what was his, I think, winning performance for that competition. It was on a video, and I saw him play that, and I said, this guy's amazing. We have to bring him here. So that was the beginning of a long working relationship and a friendship.
Tell us a little bit about Vivaldi and how he came about writing this piece. And some are saying that this is the first use of program music.
It's possible. I know that other composers have probably tried to recreate sounds of nature, but not in such an overt way. He wrote so many concertos, and he was writing them for the school that he was teaching at, for orphaned girls in Venice. And I mean, when you consider the just sheer number of concertos that he wrote, it's amazing the incredible originality and inventiveness of these concertos, and they paint such beautiful pictures. Perhaps they are some of the first program music. But he also kind of rides the fine line of trying to not just describe the seasons in nature, but he describes man in nature, and he describes our feelings about nature, our feelings about the seasons, or he describes what we feel when the heat is so strong in summer that we can't do anything. You know, it makes us lazy and tired. It's like these wonderful depictions of man and nature, and also unique not only among his works, but perhaps among most of any other concerto that I can think of. He wrote accompanying sonnets that describe it beautifully, this poetry for each of the four seasons.
William pretty much named it all. He got it. That's exactly what Vivaldi was trying to do. He was just trying to bring it to life, trying to explain the relationship between nature and man in the music. That was the best way that I've ever heard it put. And what man feels, what man hears in the beginning of summer. I really hope people listen, because you feel the dreariness of the heat. It's like you just can't take it anymore. And I live in South Florida, and I just got through the summer, so it's like, you cannot take it. And you feel it in the tempos, and then he'll all of a sudden bring to life a whole new character, the cuckoo bird, in the next section. And it's so clear how he does it. It's like, okay, we're done with that. Let's do this now. Let's experience this. And it's absolutely genius. As the maestro said, there are other composers that have tried to do this, but I don't think anyone has been this clear with it.
I love the string texture, just the brushing of the bow on the string and this unison playing. It's just so powerful and it's fun.
Yeah, we sometimes forget that these instruments are from nature. I mean, these are wood and horsehair, and were in the original times would have been even part of animal intestines for the strings. Nowadays, metal strings, of course. Yeah, I mean, these instruments particularly come out of nature, maybe more so than, let's say, the brass instruments, which are kind of more, you know, the Iron Age, right. You know, or something like that. Still part of Mother Nature, perhaps, but there's something about the wood of the string instruments that gives a warmth and a kind of resonance that's unparalleled too. This program is the start of our 60th anniversary season, and so it's a celebratory season, and one of the things that's a kind of recurring theme throughout the classics concerts that we're doing is that we're playing music that the orchestra has performed in its early days, sort of recognizing, I guess, the history of the orchestra and where we've been and now where we're going. So we have some pieces that we've performed in the first season, 10th season, 20th, 30th, 40th, and 50th season, now in our 60th season. And as I was looking at that repertoire, a theme sort of emerged. The theme was actually recommended by one of our board members, and it was a brilliant idea to explore the four elements. We have five concerts in our series, and so what to do with the fifth? Well, we had known already from the beginning that we would end this season with a staged opera. So really, we were only programming the other four, and it just fit perfectly. With this theme, Beethoven's Pastorale came immediately to mind, because for me personally and for many people, it's a piece that's special and has a sort of a place in your heart, you know? The piece is so much about the heart, and it's about feelings. And that's exactly what Beethoven was trying to do, is to not necessarily create pictures of the countryside, but to recreate the feelings of the countryside. And when I was thinking about what I would program for the Earth concert, there's so many great possibilities, you know, Mysterious Mountain or the Grand Canyon Suite. There's so much music out there that has been inspired by this beautiful planet of ours that we're on. But then I started thinking, rather than just music that might just depict a scene or a landscape, I wanted to somehow pick music that described our love of the earth. And what pieces and composers made me feel that most, more than anything, were Copland and Beethoven. I mean, when I think about Appalachian Spring or some of the other great Copland ballets from the 30s and 40s, those are some of the pieces that I think describe the beauty of American landscapes and our connection to them in a really tender and loving way. And so I thought that having Copland and Beethoven and then the Vivaldi is just another perfect fit for that.
Let's talk about Copland and the Tender Land Suite, and it isn't often performed, so it's lovely to have it on this concert.
It's my first time conducting it. I'm really excited about it, too, because I'm getting to know this piece, and the orchestra's getting to know this piece, and we're seeing a lot of different sides of Copland come through in it. There is the side that is very much like the Rodeo and Appalachian Spring and Billy the Kid side from his ballets of the 1930s, but this was written later, in around 1957-58, and it's from his only full-length opera. I should say full-length is kind of in quotes because it's really only like an hour and a half opera. But this shows sides like those other sides that have music that incorporates some folk tunes and some purposely sort of rustic elements that sort of describe American life and American landscapes. But it also has a kind of complexity about it in some of the other parts of it too. This piece is also just so much about the heart, and playing it even in rehearsals, I wanted to make sure that the musicians were getting the right sound quality, and I had to remind them, let's not force the sound here. This is still all about the heart and the feeling behind these notes. There's a section in this suite that's absolutely gorgeous. Well, so many parts of it are gorgeous, but the final movement is especially beautiful, called The Promise of Living. It's sometimes performed separately. It was originally a vocal quintet. Sometimes it's been performed by choruses as well. In this orchestral suite, there are no voices. It's just the orchestra that reaffirms this sort of like joy of life, this sort of ode to joy of Copland's. Another great sort of thematic tie-in with the Beethoven that's on this program. There's a wild party scene in the middle movement of this Tenderland suite, and the opening scene has a kind of rough introduction, and then it leads to this beautiful love music. And the piece and the title really just try to describe what life might have been like on a farm in the Midwest in the 1930s. As I said before, I have a special place in my heart for Copland and his music, and I'm just so delighted to get to explore this piece. His other works I've conducted so many times, and I'm excited to sort of rediscover a new Copland piece, which is not new, but for me and the orchestra, it's new.
I think people are starting to pull some of these pieces out and dust them off because it is such a wonderful piece. And he went back and put this together from the opera, which is really incredible himself. He actually did it.
That's right, yeah. The opera was not very well received, and he was ready to sort of move ahead and look back without, you know, trying to save it in a sense, but he ended up making some important revisions to the opera and then extracting the suite. The second production of the opera with his revisions was much more well received, and I think that might have given him the courage to extract this suite from the opera. And maybe he thought that the suite would help get more performances of the opera. The opera was unfortunately sort of kind of miscast or misproduced when it was first premiered, because he and the librettist really wrote it with the idea of writing an opera for television in mind. So then when it was produced on the large stage in New York City with a big audience expecting grand opera, it was not what they had originally intended to write it for, and so people's expectations were different. But that sort of gives us a clue as to the intimacy of the opera. The drama of the opera is an intimate drama. It's not a large scale. There's no pageantry. There's no elephants or horses, and it's not that type of opera. It's more of an opera that you'd expect from Aaron Copland, actually. And it's beautiful, and having conducted the suite now, I can't wait to get to know the rest of the opera. Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony is such a truly special piece. It's hard to imagine that he was writing it at the exact same time he was writing the Fifth Symphony, that is so full of drama and struggle and intensity. And it's so purely musical in the sense that it's abstract. And although it tells a musical story of sorts, clearly going from struggle to triumph, there are no descriptive titles to the movements, which he added to the Sixth Symphony. There are no extra, quote-unquote, musical elements that sort of come into the symphony in the Fifth. The Fifth is one of those terse pieces of abstract music that sort of like the icon of what to do with musical craftsmanship, you know, creating an entire symphony on bum, 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 bum. Whereas at the same time he was writing this piece, the Sixth Symphony, which he called the Pastorale, and which he expanded from four movements to five, and which he gave titles to each movement and gave a preface saying that this is a remembrance of country life and it's supposed to be a recreation of the feelings rather than painting pictures. Of course, he did create some specific pictures, naming specific bird calls that he has at the end of the second movement, and giving us a storm, a musical storm that is one of the probably most exciting musical storms that had been written up until that time. There have been many musical storms written after Beethoven's Pastorale that emulate it and take from what he did and go from there. But the storm here is incredibly exciting. He's very economical in other ways. It's not to say that, unlike the Fifth Symphony, the Sixth Symphony is of loose construction. It's not at all. You know, being Beethoven, he also was very careful to write a piece that formally followed very strong rules and wasn't messy or sloppy in that way at all. But it's just such a different pace and feeling than the Fifth Symphony, which he wrote at the same time and premiered on the same night. The Sixth Symphony has long stretches where the harmony doesn't change. And then when it does change, it changes in an unexpected way that's not reflective of a sort of mankind, but it's more like nature's change. I'm thinking of the moments in the first movement where he's sitting on B-flat harmony and it's just lovely and you can just see the sun coming through the leaves of the trees and you can sort of feel what it's like out in the countryside. And then all of a sudden he just, without any kind of preparation, just magically shifts to D major. And it's not the traditional harmonic change that you would expect. And I think that there was something magical about that that makes it seem like it's nature, not man. As I said earlier, like the Vivaldi piece, this is really about us in nature and our feelings about nature. The second movement is especially beautiful. Well, they're all so wonderful. The last movement too. The second movement with its beautiful accompaniment in this extremely original voicing of the strings. Many of your listeners may not realize just the careful detail and originality that Beethoven put into the accompaniment of the beginning of the second movement and throughout most of the second movement. So we have muted second violins, unmuted violas, and muted two solo cellos playing this water-like accompaniment for the scene by the brook. And the incredible originality of that, that has puzzled performers for 200 years since this was premiered in 1808. So many people have said, maybe the violas should also be muted, or maybe nobody should be muted, or what should we do? How are we going to make sense out of this? Why did he do it this way? If you follow him to the letter, I find that you realize that he knew what he was doing. And as I revisit Beethoven's symphonies over and over and over again, as I get a little older, I go more and more back to the print and try to follow it to the letter. We're very lucky that with Beethoven's symphonies in the 1990s, historians and musicologists got together and created a new critical edition that really reflects more accurately exactly what he wrote, and without any of the layers of editorial additions that may have gathered there for 100 years or 200 years. And so we're lucky to have these editions that allow us to get a look at the real, quote-unquote, Beethoven and what he might have really wanted. And he really loved the countryside, and he would go out there for inspiration. And one of the things that I love about what he wrote in one of his letters was that nobody loves nature more than me. I can't get enough of it. I have to be out in nature every day if I can. And one of the things that I really love, he wrote, when you're looking at the trees and the stones and you're out in the woods in nature, everything seems to be saying, holy, holy, holy. So here was a deeply spiritual man, not necessarily part of an organized religion, but a deeply spiritual man who found a sort of spirituality in nature. And when you see that reflected in the music, more often than in any other symphony of his, he uses what we consider to be the traditional sort of holy cadence, when he goes from like a one chord to a four chord, and it has this feeling that it's a prayer. In fact, near the very end of the fifth movement, near the end of this whole symphony, everything winds down after this glorious climax that's an incredible just sort of embrace of life and love and thanksgiving. After that, it winds down to this tender moment that he's written sotto voce, under your breath, as if you're praying to yourself. And it is a musical prayer that Beethoven writes at the end, a prayer of thanksgiving. So this is spiritual music, and it's gorgeous, and it's beautiful, and we're so lucky to have it.
And a brilliant way to end your concert. Now, he also connects these last three movements as well. They kind of flow into each other.
They do. There's sort of a storytelling here. The Merry Gathering of the Peasants is the third movement, Scherzo, with a purposely sort of rustic, unsophisticated kind of theme. And accompanying a solo oboe, there's a particularly wonderful moment with Beethoven's sense of humor, with the second bassoon imitating a country bandsman doing a sort of rough accompaniment to the oboe. That gives way to the storm, and the gathering of the country folks has to disperse suddenly because they can sense the storm is coming. The storm comes, and with it, the first entrance of the trombone, timpani, and piccolo, who have been waiting for the first two movements just to be able to play. And the trumpets enter in the third movement. The storm comes in, the other instruments join in, and the timpani especially is used to great effect to recreate the thunder and so forth. And then that gives way to what's almost like a rainbow after a storm, this beautiful shepherd song that opens the final movement. The way that those three movements connect is brilliant and original. And the only other example I can think of right off the bat is the third movement to the fourth movement of the Fifth Symphony that he wrote at the same time. The sort of darkness that leads to this glorious sunlight triumph finale. This one has a different feeling, but there's a similar kind of transition. And let's not forget that in 1807, 1808, movements of symphonies really weren't connected in that way. In fact, finales of symphonies were very often such separate pieces that they didn't really connect to the first, second, or third movements of symphonies oftentimes. But Beethoven not only gives us a model for connecting all the movements together in an organic whole, whether it be thematically or in terms of the feelings and the emotions, but he also gives us this sort of new approach to how a symphony should end. What happens to the ending of a piece? And he shifts the focus from a first movement focus that earlier composers had to the finale.